From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Baseball players may soon go out on strike. On today's Fresh Air, what do the players and owners want? We talk with John Hellyer, author of a new book about the business of baseball called Lords of the Realm. He also writes about sports for the Wall Street Journal. Hellyer describes the baseball crisis as egomaniacs and economics run amok. Also today, a new film about teenage sexual frustration and incest. We talk with David Russell, director of Spanking the Monkey. It won the Audience Award for the most popular dramatic film at this year's Sundance Film Festival. And Maureen Corrigan reviews No Gifts from Chance, the new biography of Edith Wharton. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The National League won last night's All-Star Game. Now the big question is, who's going to prevail in the baseball talks? Talks resume tomorrow between the players and the owners. The players may go out on strike. My guest John Hellyer is the author of a new book about the business side of baseball called The Lords of the Realm, The Real History of the Game. He also writes about sports for the Wall Street Journal. He co-authored the bestseller Barbarians at the Gate. Hellyer opens his new book by reminding us that before baseball was ever a business, it was a game. Just keep reminding yourself of that as we run through the big disagreements between the players and the owners.
The owners and players, as is their custom, are on different planets about the state of baseball today. The owners feel as though they need some radical changes in the way the system is structured. They want the players to agree to a salary cap, and the players basically feel as though the industry is not in the kind of distress that would require them to make that sacrifice.
What's the salary cap formula that the owners want?
The owners want to take the total pot of revenues in baseball, and they're proposing to split that 50-50 with the players.
So how would that work?
Basically, you have, in effect, a free market system in baseball now. You do have a salary cap in baseball, in basketball, rather, where there's been a 53% cap. The National Football League has, in effect, about a 64% salary cap, and that percentage means that's the amount of the total revenues in the sport that the owners are willing to pay to the players in salary.
So
baseball has no such cap. According to the owner's side, baseball players this year will make about 58% of the total revenues in salaries.
If there is a salary cap imposed, which kinds of players and which kinds of teams would be most affected?
It would really be probably the richer teams that would be affected more. There are teams that now have payrolls in the $40 to $50 million range, and that would have to come down under this. The teams that would benefit really would be the ones on the lower end of the scale that can't afford to have higher salaries, because what would also kick in under this scheme would be a revenue sharing proposal between teams, so that the richer teams would be sharing some of their revenues with the poorer teams. So it would basically even things out. I think the players that would probably get hurt under this are the middle tier of players, the ones that aren't so great that they can command the higher dollars. And I have a feeling that, as in the National Football League today, they would get squeezed out, the veteran, solid but not spectacular player.
Now, also, the players want to continue with salary arbitration, but the owners don't want salary arbitration.
Salary arbitration is the bane of the owner's existence. The way Jerry Reinsdorf of the White Sox put it, he said, baseball is the only industry where I have to pay a player what my dumbest competitor pays. And what he means by that is that salary arbitration for players that have between 3 and 5 years' experience in the major leagues means that if they can't come to an agreement with the team on their salary, they can take it to an arbitrator and argue, each side can argue the case for what the salary should be, and then the arbitrator has to choose one or the other. And what the players and their agents are very good at is keying off the highest salary they can at a particular position or for a particular experience level. And it has a, it definitely does have an inflationary aspect to it for baseball payrolls.
So if one player gets a lot, then the next player will find it easier through salary arbitration to get a lot too, to get that figure.
That's right. For instance, Matt Williams of the San Francisco Giants got an exceedingly generous salary when he was just a second-year player that was going to pay him $600,000 one year and then $2 million the next. Well, that raised the ante for all young third basemen. They could take that to salary arbitration and say, hey, Matt Williams is making that. I'm at least half as good as Matt Williams, so I should be able to get $1 million.
In your book, Lords of the Realm, you write that owners really fought against free agency, but they didn't realize the real enemy for them was salary arbitration. In fact, the owners voted for salary arbitration 22-2. What changed? What is different now from what they expected salary arbitration to be like?
The reason was they threw salary arbitration to the players as a sop originally back in 1973. There was no free agency then, and it's really the combination of the two that became deadly. It's because the players that are eligible for salary arbitration can key off what players have been getting in the free agent market. So the rising tide of free agency salaries lifts all boats among the arbitration-eligible players.
Are the owners in bad shape now? Are they suffering with declining revenues?
I think what's happening really is that baseball does have one economic problem, and that is the danger of a permanent underclass of teams in smaller cities like Montreal, Pittsburgh, San Diego. They have really fallen way behind the richer teams. The teams on the bottom end of the scale in baseball have something like $40 to $50 million in revenues, and the teams at the upper end can top $100 million. That's a tremendous disparity of resources, and that does make it harder for the Pittsburghs and the Montreals to compete. But it's hard to assess the overall industry when some clubs are minting money and others definitely are losing money. And what the players are really arguing is that the overall state of the industry is not such that they should have to make these givebacks.
Are these talks that might lead to a strike really about a shift in the balance of power between players and owners?
Exactly. This is really a fight for control. It gets couched in sophisticated economic arguments, but it's really a matter of a balance of power. And the owners had total control of this game, this business, for over 100 years. That got turned upside down in the 1970s, when the players made dramatic gains in areas like free agency and salary arbitration. And every negotiation since then has represented an effort by the owners to get back some measure of control. Unfortunately, so far for them, they've mostly been unsuccessful.
I think a lot of fans are fed up with the owners and the players now.
That's a very correct observation. I think... most would say a pox on both of their houses. The frustrating thing, I think, for many fans is that they feel like they care more about this game than the people who play it or run it. And the two sides think they're playing a game of chicken with each other, but they're also playing a game of chicken with the public's affection. It is basically a bad business principle to continually test and strain your consumers' loyalty, and that's what baseball seems to keep doing.
If there is a strike, what do you think the economic impact of the strike could be?
Clearly, not that much outside the realm of baseball, but within baseball, there'll be a lot of money lost on both sides. The players have probably in excess of $150 million reserve in their union to see them through these rainy days, but given the current the current level of baseball salaries, they could burn through that in a month. Whereas the owners in those parks where they're really filling them up every night with 45, 48,000, they stand to make big losses in a hurry. I think for that reason, I'm predicting this is going to be the Persian Gulf War of baseball strikes. I think there's just too much economic pressure on both sides to settle, and I would see maybe a 2 or 3 week strike, something of that on that magnitude.
John Hellyer is my guest. His new book is called Lords of the Realm, The Real History of Baseball, and it's an economic history of baseball. Let's talk a little bit about the gap between the have and have-not baseball teams. What's the current state of revenue sharing in baseball?
The teams share their gate receipts on a formula of roughly 80-20. 80% of the ticket money goes to the home team, 20% to the visitors. That's in the American League. The National League has an even wider split. The visitors don't get very much. The teams also share 25% of their cable TV money. That is, if the Phillies have a game on cable TV that they get revenues from, 25% of that has to go to the visitor. And then they share equally the national TV money, their contracts with ABC, NBC, and ESPN. And that's pretty much the extent of it. Plus, they share their licensing revenue.
So how does that compare to, say, the NFL?
The NFL is a much more socialistic enterprise. They basically share all their TV money. They have five national TV contracts. They share that equally. There are no local packages to speak of. And they have a much more equal gate split, 60% for the home team, 40% for the visitors. That's been the key in the NFL to a team in Green Bay being able to compete on essentially equal footing with a team in New York.
Why are the owners against more revenue sharing?
Well, it's really the richer owners that are against more revenue sharing. They tend to look upon the poorer owners as a combination of socialists and welfare chiselers every time they want to raid their coffers. George Steinbrenner used to get up at these meetings and say to the small market owners, "Comrades, I'm not going to give you a cent of my money just so you don't have to work." And that's really the way they see it. It's the time-honored WIIFM principle, what's in it for me? And there's certainly nothing in this for the richer owners to have to part with some of their hard-won profits.
How about the health of the game?
You would hope that they would look at it in terms of the health of the game, but basically it's like any other business. Even though it's baseball, you're really looking at your own interest first. And the key point here is that whereas the NFL has been structurally set up to take care of the weaker teams and to level things out, and so has the National Basketball Association, in the sense that they do have a long-standing salary cap, which also equalizes teams to a great extent. Baseball, I think, perhaps because it goes back to the days of the robber barons, has a much greater history of rugged individualism and an approach that says that each team is allowed to be run by its owner as the lord of his particular realm. And it just is a more intractable problem in baseball.
There's a Baseball Network executive who proposed this theory to you about television and sports. He said that baseball saw network TV as a means of acquiring capital, but the NBA saw it as a partner and a tool for promoting and extending the game. What do you think have been the basic differences in the way baseball and basketball approach television?
The National Basketball Association has been a much more marketing-driven organization. They only go back to the 1940s as a professional league, and I think had a much greater sense that they really had to hustle and really promote themselves in order to vault into the upper reaches of the American sporting conscience. Baseball takes its public love very much for granted. It goes back 125 years as a professional sport. It is deeply ingrained in our national consciousness and culture. Baseball feels like, I'm baseball, I don't have to do this, and much to its detriment. I think some of the individual teams are very good at marketing themselves. Baseball now has almost a dozen teams that will probably draw 2 million fans a year, so you know somebody's doing something right in terms of promoting baseball. But on a league-wide, baseball-wide basis, baseball just doesn't do it like the NBA does or even like the NFL does.
John Hellyer is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Lords of the Realm, The Real History of Baseball. John, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Hellyer, author of a new book on the economic history of baseball called Lords of the Realm. He's also the co-author of the bestseller Barbarians at the Gate. One of the things that you looked into in your new history of baseball is the real economic reasons why the Dodgers moved from Brooklyn to L.A., and what did you find?
I found that Brooklyn will still no more forgive Walter O'Malley now than they ever could, but it's easy to understand in looking at baseball in current days and just in terms of economics. Brooklyn was undergoing a period of change. It was becoming much more brown, black, and other immigrant oriented, and their historical fan base was moving to the suburbs in the 1950s. Ebbets Field was much beloved, but much limited in terms of its seating capacity. It was a little 32,000 capacity stadium. Walter O'Malley, the owner, could not convince Brooklyn to, New York City, I should say, to do anything about building him a new stadium. So he cast his eyes westward, and fortunately found that a city westward was casting its eyes for a Major League Baseball team. The city of Los Angeles had sent a county supervisor to the World Series in 1955 to try and scout out possible teams to relocate to Los Angeles. Walter O'Malley knew everything that was going on in baseball, and he found out that the owner of the Senators had had a meeting with this county supervisor. He sends a note to the county supervisor, a three-word note at the World Series, saying simply, "Don't sign anything." Within a month, Walter O'Malley had swooped in and claimed the greener pastures of Los Angeles for himself. And the importance of O'Malley and that particular move, traumatic as it was for New York and for Brooklyn, was O'Malley was really on the cutting edge of the modern owner as businessman and waving goodbye to baseball as a sport forever.
You see him as the cutting edge of owner as businessman. What are the other ways the owners have changed as a group?
I think borrowing the approach of Walter O'Malley, they've become much more willing to hold up whatever city they're in for whatever it is they feel they want. Mm-hmm. You've seen numerous cases of teams threatening to move, their preferred venue being Tampa Bay in Florida, where they have a nice dome stadium sitting open, in order to extract what they can from their city in terms of a new stadium or new luxury boxes or, you know, whatever it is they feel like they need to make that more profitable. I've illustrated in the book with the White Sox came within an inch of moving to Florida. The magnificent Camden Yards Stadium in Baltimore is only a result of Edward Bennett Williams, the Orioles' then owner, refusing to sign anything more than a one-year lease at the old Memorial Stadium, and in effect put a gun to the city of Baltimore's head. And Baltimore, already having been traumatized at losing the Baltimore Colts to Indianapolis, caved and built that stadium, which is magnificent, but is also a tribute to the brinksmanship approach of the modern owner.
Well, do you think that that's one way that the modern owner is actually helping the fan? Because one of the things the fan gets is bigger and better ballparks.
He is helping the fan, but the fan is also a taxpayer who is paying for that modern ballpark, usually. And I think that's really what has to be thought of in terms of a public policy issue. Is a baseball team or any sports team worth what cities invest in them? And clearly, there's a lot of politicians that have made the decision that it is. They're willing to put out the public funds to help teams But it's a pretty thorny issue as to whether on a cold-blooded economic basis as opposed to an emotional basis, a team is really worth all that much to a city.
So would it be fair to sum up one of the major issues at stake in the talks now is that some teams are losing money, and the players are saying, if you want to straighten that out, they're saying to the owners, if you want to straighten that out, there should be more revenue sharing. And the owners are saying, we'll only consider more revenue sharing if there's salary caps.
That's it precisely, Tara. In fact, I think that qualifies you for a place at the bargaining table, unfortunately. Nobody's ever put it that concisely and well. But that's it exactly. The owners, after fighting among themselves for more than a year about what form, if any, revenue sharing would take, were only willing to do it if it was something in which they would get concessions from the players in return.
Your best-selling book, Barbarians at the Gate, was about RJR Nabisco. It was about takeover fever. And I'm wondering how you think the heads of big corporate enterprises like that compare with the owners of baseball in terms of what kind of businessmen they are and what kind of temperaments they have in business.
Actually, the two stories had more in common than I thought they would when I started out doing the research. There's both a full complement of egomaniacs and economics run amok. I think what the difference is in baseball is that it's not just about money. It's about control of the national pastime and pennants and glory. And that really makes people do stranger things in baseball than in the normal world of publicly held businesses. And I think there's an incredibly wide range of business abilities among people who run teams. Some of them are very sharp. Walter O'Malley, I've mentioned, was very shrewd, and his son Peter O'Malley, who now runs the Dodgers, continues to be an excellent businessman. That's the family business. On the other hand, there are hobbyists who get into baseball, and they may have done very well in other businesses, but they check their business sense at the door. And Ewan Kauffman, the late owner of the Kansas City Royals, was willing to lose $10 million a year in the Kansas City Royals just because he wanted to have this kind of civic institution for his city.
One last thing, any behind-the-scenes things you'd like to tell us about the player's rep in these negotiations, Donald Fair, and the owner's rep, Dick Ravitch?
They don't much like each other. Is that good enough for you?
Yeah, but that wasn't a big surprise.
I'm not sure how important that is, though. I think what's really important is the constituencies they represent. It doesn't make any difference if they act like sumo wrestlers in the negotiating room. It's really what kind of motivations their respective constituencies bring to them, and they're really just carrying that out. As somebody on the management side said to me recently, the only way these players are going to see the light is when they're on their back looking up at it, and that's really the essence of it. I'm afraid that this will come down to a contest of wills. So far, over the past 20 years, which is what I mostly chronicle in Lords of the Realm, the players have had the advantage. They've been much more consistently able to stay unified than the owners, and this is just the new chapter.
Well, John Hellyer, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
John Hellyer is the author of Lords of the Realm, The Real History of Baseball. He writes about the business of sports for The Wall Street Journal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Most of us who've left home know what it's like to go back for a visit and be drawn into the same old patterns. Filmmaker David Russell started with that idea and took it to an extreme. Coming up, Russell tells us about his new film, Spanking the Monkey, about a son who goes home to nurse his ailing mother, and their relationship turns incestuous. And Maureen Corrigan reviews No Gifts from Chance, the new biography of writer Edith Wharton by Shari Benstock. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Spanking the Monkey is a new film about teenage frustration. When the film opens, Raymond, an MIT freshman, is returning to his parents' house for a visit before heading down to Washington for a prestigious internship with the Surgeon General. But as soon as he gets off the bus, his father hits him with bad news. Raymond's mother's broken her leg, and his father is heading off on a long sales trip. So Raymond has to stay home, take care of his mother, and spend the summer cooped up in the house he grew up in. Spanking the Monkey won the Audience Award for the most popular dramatic film at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The film was written and directed by my guest David Russell. It's his first feature film. Russell described the feeling in his film of being trapped at home just after you've managed to leave for the first time.
I think the emotional web of our parents, of our homes, lasts a lot longer than our physical presence does, you know. So it's a feeling of being entangled, you know. I mean, there are all the different rules and regulations of his father at the airport, all the arcane reasoning of the home. You know, you've been outside of the home, you've been free of it, and all of a sudden you're back in the strange logic and the strange rules that every house has unto itself. And so he's hearing the rules and the chores he has to do about the dog and the car, and then there's the emotion of a feeling stymied, which I think kind of begins a burner of anger in him, you know, that doesn't really explode till later in the film.
Did you grow up in a suburb and then go to out-of-town college?
Yes, I did. I grew up in Larchmont, went to Amherst College, and one summer in particular, after my sister had left and I my mother had a bad car accident, I kind of ended up there. I was working painting houses, and it's strange, you know. Your room can be the same as when you left it, which is sort of a bizarre shrine to your childhood, and you've shed that skin, but now you've been asked to put it back on to be in the house, and because I think it's an unusual house that shifts gears and starts to treat the child like an adult, and it certainly isn't the case in this film.
No, your main character has to take care of his mother because she has a broken leg, and the father's out on a long sales trip. So he has to help her shower, has to help get her to the toilet. He massages her legs with lotion. And this all leads to dangerous sexual territory. And I'm wondering why you wanted to take the screenplay in that direction.
I think the power of the film is based on the idea that you have something that's of great mythical proportions in a banal suburban setting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of great drama comes from sinful kind of heavy areas that are troublesome, you know. And I like to quote Jung a lot, who said that the cinema is the place where we go to experience our most dangerous fantasies and experiences that we don't really enable ourselves to have. And if an art film, I think, can do that emotionally in a way that a Hollywood film doesn't. So I wanted to go into that territory, you know, and I wanted to deal with the emotions. I wanted to kind of refract the emotions of a family through that lens and look at what goes on in terms of power relationships and manipulation through that.
I was thinking back to when I was in my late teens and I was reviewing the men who I was close to then, and I was guessing that probably none of them had sexual feelings about their mothers. And I'm thinking of the men who I actually knew something about their relationship with their mothers. Do you think I'm kidding myself? I mean, do you think that this is usually lurking behind the relationship?
Do you disagree with Freud?
I often disagree with Freud. I'll admit that.
No, I think those sexual feelings are always there. I think that it's a matter of violation and transgression. And he was really the whole film is about him, his selfhood being kind of transgressed in many ways that are considered trivial. And I think it's funny that people consider them trivial until they turn sexual. They're not trivial. And the sexual undertow, I think, emphasizes it even more. Around where I grew up, 19-year-old boys were thinking about sex a lot of the time. We're thinking about sex with other guys' mothers. Mm-hmm. I think that Mrs. Robinson is one step removed. And I think that's very Oedipal. You know, I think in a deep unconscious level, I don't know that it's about Mrs. Robinson as much as the mother. And I think it's ultimately kind of it's a deep, dark thing.
I was trying to imagine what it's been like for you to explain this movie to your parents and what it's been like for your parents to explain this movie to their friends and relatives. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most difficult things for a writer must be explaining the characters to all the people who imagine it's about them, you know, that this character is based on them. So did you worry about what your parents would think when you wrote a movie that had something to do with incest?
Sure I did. You know, I knew that when I picked up the idea, I knew that it was provocative, and that's why I liked it. And I think that's why it's gotten the response that it has. It got me great writing assignments in Hollywood, and it gets responses from audiences because it's provocative, not simply because it's provocative, but I mean it's not gratuitous or exploitative, and I think it's a balancing act that we managed to pull off. I was uncomfortable about it. I think my parents are proud of the work. I think they're also uncomfortable about it. You know, their friends have called me to congratulate me.
Did they say, and this never really happened in your house, did it?
No, they would never come forward and ask me that. My sister asked me that, actually.
Did she really?
Yeah. And no, you know, I think our house was, life in our house was a lot more boring than the house in the movie. I mean, I think that it's been pushed to extremes for dramatic purposes.
But it must be frightening to write a screenplay like this, knowing that it's somehow inviting people to think things of you that never happened.
Yeah, but I think that's the emotional territory you want to go into, because it's. I think some of the most powerful material a writer or filmmaker can go into is self-revealing, and I knew that's what inspired me to make the film. I had written and directed two short films that had played on cable and been at festivals, and I would describe them as being glib, clever, and ironic. And I would describe a lot of the independent cinema I see as glib, clever, and ironic. And I don't think it takes a lot of emotional risks. And some of it is kind of hip. And I had grants from the NEA and the New York State Council on the Arts to make my next film for 2 years, and I didn't use that money because I didn't want to make a film that was not going after something more substantial. And I looked at Gus Van Sant, who was kind of an inspiration to me, and I said, he seems to have tapped into something with Drugstore Cowboy and Private Idaho, although I didn't like all of that second film. I thought the heart of it was really interesting. And especially in his first film, Malanoche. And I said, what did he do? You know, he delved into some of the darkest parts of his psyche. And I said, well, and I was looking at myself. And I think this is what I had been avoiding as a writer. And I think that it's why my work hadn't really become more powerful as a writer. And I said, what do I have? You know, I'm not gay. That isn't something that I can go into and expose and deal with and bring out. And what I had was kind of the material of the town I grew up in and the house I grew up in. And some of the more dangerous feelings that were there. And yeah, there was a sense of taking up a dare and feeling the potential embarrassment of saying to the world, I'm someone who thought about these matters. I'm someone who thought about these sexual situations. You know, and but people don't come up to me and say, I never thought of that. You know, as you say, you thought about the 19-year-olds you knew when you were that age. Many people say that it rings very true to them.
My guest is David Russell. He wrote and directed the new film Spanking the Monkey. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with David Russell about his new film, Spanking the Monkey. You know what I found disturbing about the parents? Not just the sexual edge, but the fact that, you know, a son comes home for a few days on his way to a prized internship that is given to only 10 students a year to serve with the Secretary General. That's really something. And the parents find a way to prevent him from going. And, you know, I think of parents as being people who will do anything to help their children and help them succeed. And here's parents who just, you know, could have found a way to let him go and don't. And that made me sad.
Oh, it's definitely sad. It's a craziness. You know, a woman in Boston from the Globe, when interviewing me, said that it made her think of a Ren and Stimpy episode that's a bootleg, actually, because they wouldn't air it because it was too disturbing. And it's called Man's Best Friend. And it's Ren and Stimpy are bought by a man who takes them home. And he tells them, now this is the couch, this is for humans, you're never allowed to go on the couch. Okay, is that clear? And they say, fine. And then later he says, why don't you sit on the couch? Would you like to sit on the couch? And they sit on the couch. And he says, get off the couch, what the hell's the matter with you? And this is kind of the mental torture they go through. And that there's a fair amount of that in the film. And I see that in my house and other houses where there are these convoluted series of rules that have it both ways. I think his mother wants to live vicariously through him and urge him on to glory. The problem with that is that it's not always so simple. If someone is living vicariously through you, maybe there's a part in that person who doesn't really want you to succeed, because then it's going to accentuate finally the fact that it's your life, not her life. And I think I experienced that in my home. There's a double-edged sword about parents who want to urge their children on for glory.
Now, your film was made on a really low budget, $80,000 or something?
Well, that's what we had. It's deceptive, Terry. That's what we had going into production, because, you know, in cash. We had the grants from the NEA and the New York State Council on the Arts, and then private funding, and we had to get short ends of other directors' films to use for our film stock. We got film from Carlito's Way and from House Party 3 and other films.
Short ends is the film left over on a reel when someone's done with it?
Exactly. Which is very hard on the actors, because sometimes they're mislabeled. So it'll say 800 feet, but it's really 400. So you say, okay, that's enough to shoot this really heavy scene. So the actors get it up and they're crying or they're doing whatever they have to do. And then you roll out in the middle of the scene and you go, oh, hold it. And you reload and then it happens again. So it was doubly hard on the actors. Mm-hmm. But that's what we had, $80 in cash. And we bartered for our motel rooms. We made an industrial film about the motel that put up the cast and the crew. That was my first project after Spanking Wrapped. Was the Holiday Hills industrial video. But then everybody had deferred contracts, which meant that everybody's getting paid when we get paid by Finelon. When you add those in, plus $130,000 from Stanley Buckthal, one of the producers of Hairspray, which he gave us for post-production, the budget overall comes to over $500,000.
Now, if I read this correctly, you were offered $1 million by a distributor if you could come up with a name actress
right,
to play the part of the mother. What happened? You couldn't come up with somebody.
It's very tough. You know, you try to get the script. You can't even get the script to these people, because their agents live in terror of their powerful clients. So Susan Sarandon's agent, Jessica Lange's agent, we'd come to them with our script, you know, and they'd look at this, and it would have written all over it to them, don't show this to my client. Because to them, they're afraid they're going to take it to Susan Sarandon, and she's going to say, a low-budget film about this controversial material with a first-time director? Are you insane? Are you trying to destroy my career?
Well, I think when a very well-known actor or actress does a director's first feature film, it means one of two things, usually that actor or actress is washed up, or that actor or actress has spotted something like so hip that they just had to do it, and it's this...
Or that really speaks to them.
Or that really speaks to them, right. Right. So it's either like real hip or real washed up, and there doesn't seem to be a kind of in-between statement that you're making.
Yeah. I mean, the hip thing we didn't have happening for us in the sense that, like I said, it's not a hip movie, and I'm proud of that. It's icky. It deals with icky emotions. You can't be hip and deal with really serious emotions, you know. And I do not want to ever be cool, in that sense, because cool is literally cool. It doesn't have a lot of emotional heat. I'm the opposite end of the spectrum, and I'm glad I know that about myself now, and that's the kind of work I'm going to do. I like messy, heated, sexual, emotional situations.
There really are two different film worlds now: the independent world and the big budget world.
Yes, there certainly are. And I'll tell you a funny story about that. I'm trying to navigate my way up the middle because I'd like to make films on the scale of Woody Allen, which is, you know, under 10 million, under 5 million even, with great ensemble casts that maybe add up to one marquee name collectively, you know, but are not dominated by one star. I believe that's the milieu where you can make these messy, emotional, sexual films that I want to make and still have them possibly make profits. I had a meeting with Sidney Pollack's company, Mirage. They liked the film very much, and I was meeting with an executive there about my next project, and I told him the story of it, and he said he liked it quite a bit, and he asked me, how much would you like to make this movie for? And I said, I think I could make this movie for $5 million. And he made a face, he scowled, and he said, I don't think we can make it for $5 million. He said, can you make it for $10 million? and I was kind of speechless because, I mean, this was my induction to Hollywood, you know? And I think it's the credo of, like, a lot of investment bankers. The stakes have to be high enough for them, you know, in the terms of their own fees and what they could make down the line. And that scares me because the higher the price goes, you see this with the Coen brothers with Hudsucker Proxy, you know, the higher the price tag goes, the more dangerous water you're getting into with your more challenging material, because there are audiences who want to see more challenging material, but they're not in malls all over America. You know, they're in cities, they're in some towns, and the higher the number gets, the dicier it is for you to make your money back. And we all know that when you don't make your money back, it's harder to get your next one out of the box.
So you're going to do your film for $10 million?
I hope not. God, I mean, I don't know. You know, I mean, I would like to make it for closer to $5 million. I will, if somebody insists on doing it for that, I'll be a little more nervous about it. Because, you know, that means they're going to be all over me again. You know, which in Spanking the Monkey, we suffered with 18-hour days and cheap motels. But we had our own show. Nobody was coming in. And it's hard enough to figure out how to make it good on your own without having people coming in and breathing on down your neck about money. So... I hope to not make it for 10. If we get, you know, maybe they'll argue that to get the kind of cast that I want, it requires that, but we'll see.
Well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry, for your provocative and probing questions. You made me squirm in my seat for a while, but I think we finally managed to get through the interview.
David Russell wrote and directed the new film Spanking the Monkey. It opens in New York and L.A. on Friday. It comes to other cities beginning July 22nd. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, Terry, we'll be hearing today about a report issued by the Pentagon of their investigation of the Friendly Fire incident in April. That was when a U.S. plane flying over northern Iraq mistakenly shot down an American helicopter and killed all those aboard. Also today, we'll be bringing you up to date on health care reform. Elizabeth Arnold tells us what's been happening in Congress. We'll hear the thoughts on that congressional discussion of health care reform of C. Everett Koop, the former Surgeon General. And we'll also be hearing about the Roman Catholic Bishop's position on abortion and health care reform. Also, day two of the Stephen Breyer confirmation hearings.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This past year, we've been in the midst of a kind of Edith Wharton revival. There was last fall's film, The Age of Innocence, and the republication of some of Wharton's lesser-known and even unfinished novels like The Buccaneers. Now there's a new in-depth Edith Wharton biography called No Gifts from Chance by Shari Benstock. Critic Maureen Corrigan says Benstock gives Wharton back her New York moxie.
The image of Edith Wharton as an ambitious writer who worked up a sweat or even a ladylike glow over her manuscripts is one that's been downplayed by previous biographers and by Wharton herself. In her autobiography, Wharton portrayed herself as an insecure, simple soul chosen by destiny to be a great writer. But Shari Benstock's Edith Wharton sounds more like Donald Trump than Forrest Gump. Wharton wrote her first novel when she was 11. That never got published, but 47 other books did. She also became adept at wheeling and dealing with publishers. As Wharton told a friend, "Writing is my business as well as my passion." By 1905, the year she first began keeping track of her literary earnings, Wharton had made the equivalent in today's money of some $2 million in royalties and serial contracts. That was years before she wrote that Pulitzer Prize-winning blockbuster, The Age of Innocence. In Shari Benstock's new biography, she explores how Edith Wharton transformed herself from a shy debutante into an international literary eminence, a woman who could hold her own with male friends like Henry James and Bernard Berenson. At her birth in 1862, the only thing New York society expected of Edith Newbold Jones was that she marry well. She did grow up to marry, and later divorce, Teddy Wharton. He was an unimaginative man who Henry James judged to be cerebrally compromised. Here's how Wharton described her long years of marital loneliness in her short story, The Fullness of Life. "I have sometimes thought that a woman's nature is like a great house. There is the drawing room, where one receives formal visits, the sitting room, where members of the family come and go, but beyond that are other rooms, the handles of whose doors perhaps are never turned. And in the innermost room, the soul sits alone and waits for a footstep that never comes." But a footstep, so to speak, did come along once in Wharton's life. When she was in her 40s, she had an affair with Morton Fullerton, a professional journalist and cad. Benstock is the first biographer to have access to their full correspondence, and the love letters she quotes by Wharton are surprisingly sensual. Underlying the emotional turmoil of Wharton's life was her writing. She was a disciplined, even compulsive writer. In 1905, The House of Mirth was serialized in Scribner's magazine, and Wharton's career as a novelist took off. She also churned out magazine articles, poems, travel pieces, books on architecture, and ghost stories. Wharton's writing schedule even weathered her grueling charity work in France during World War I. Every biography, of course, is a product of its time and its author's biases. Shari Benstock is a feminist critic, and so the Edith Wharton she gives us is a kind of unconscious, early model power feminist. Judging from Wharton's extraordinary public career, I think Benstock's interpretation is closer to the truth than those neurotic, demure images of Wharton we've gotten in the past. One quibble, though. I do wish Benstock hadn't decided to take the liberty throughout this biography of referring to Wharton as Edith. This first name familiarity has cropped up in other biographies recently, and I hope it's not a new trend. Somehow, I think the Edith Wharton who wrote so nostalgically about the social codes of old New York would not approve.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed the new Edith Wharton biography, No Gifts from Chance, by Shari Benstock. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.